Et ce village.
Yes.
Ouais.
Excellent.
Merci, bonne journée.
Bonne journée, merci.
À la prochaine, au revoir.
Hello, welcoming you just after midday, Tuesday the 12th of March. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of this slightly unusual episode of the Cycling Podcast as I clamber through undergrowth on the southern flank of the Col d'Huez, the Mediterranean glistening several hundred metres between my feet, a brook bubbling beside me as I search for a co-host who I'm told, resides here.
Hey, Daniel.
It is the co-host himself. Lucky Larry Warbass. I've breached the defences of Chateau Warbass. And what a beautiful place, Larry.
Thanks, yeah.
Oh, thank
you. Happy to have you here.
We've got company. Who's this?
This is Blanco. He's the famous chien of the house.
Named after the ill-fated predecessor of Jumbo-Visma.
Exactly, yeah. If he ever has a kid, we'll name it Jumbo, so...
Well, Larry, I said it's going to be an unusual episode. It is. Well, it's a special episode. I feel very privileged, and hopefully the listeners feel privileged as well, to be behind the walls, behind the defences of Chateau Warbass. What a magnificent setting, Larry. Just describe the scene that you wake up to, that greets you whenever you step out your front door.
Yeah, so we're kind of here. We're in Ez Village, which is just under the Col d'Huez and a little above the sea. We're at about 350 meters of elevation here. And yeah, we have a nice view of the village. It's like one of the plus beau villages de France.
Aren't they all? You see that sign pretty much when you go into any village in France.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. So it's like, they call them like a village perché, so like a perched village. It's like, on a cliffside overlooking the sea. We aren't in the old village, we're just next to it. But yeah, you can, so we have a nice view of the village, and then in the winter we have a nice view of the sea too, because there aren't any leaves on the trees. But once the leaves come in summer, we don't really see the sea, but it's a cool place.
I was with your good friend, former flatmate, former landlord, I learned yesterday, Rob. Joe Dombrowski, yesterday in the Vieux-Port in Nice, and he suggested I would need some kind of machete to negotiate and navigate the trail leading to Chateau Warbass, Castello Warbass. But it's a very beautifully appointed trail staircase.
It could use a little bit of work, but
it
still,
could.
Yeah.
But it's it is a beautifully secluded spot.
Yeah.
Larry, you're just back from Tirreno Adriatico. I've been at Paris a week, and we're going to compare notes, aren't we, later in this, as I say, special episode. Last week we had an episode where it was sort of, but I said it was going back and forth in the space-time continuum, past, present, future. Today's episode is going to be a bit like that. Maybe we'll talk about San Remo. That's on your agenda for later in the week. Your notes from Tirreno as well. And we're also going to be talking to another another adopted Niçois and indeed compatriot that you know well. You're Captain America, of course, former national champion, but we'll be discussing whether Matteo Jorgensen is the sort of new de facto Captain America as far as professional cycling is concerned.
I think I'm going to keep the title, but I can guide him along the way, so he can be the we'll see. Maybe if he wins national championships, which I'm sure he will do one day, we can pass on the torch, but for now I'll keep it. But we're very proud of the young, very strong Matteo.
Well, Larry, should we go inside?
Yeah,
and do the business.
Sweet.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Babbel. Learn the language of your choice at the pace that's right for you. Now, Babbel is an app, so you can choose when and where you want to learn, and even just 10 minutes a day will get you on the road to learning a new language. Right now, Babbel is offering all of our listeners an additional 6 months free with the purchase of every 6 month subscription. You just need the promo code CYCLE24, that's CYCLE24. Go to babbel.com/play and use the promo code CYCLE24 to get an additional 6 months for free. There are so many different ways to learn with Babbel, language lessons, podcasts and games, and they all help to put in place the building blocks of the language you want to learn. And you can choose from 14 different languages, including English, if it's not your first language. Maybe you listen to the cycling podcast to brush up on your English skills, or maybe not, I don't know. But by the summer, by the time the Grand Tours come around, you could be well on the way to learning Italian, French or Spanish, or one of the other languages, if you please. The one thing about Babbel is that it's fun and it's flexible, and most importantly, you're learning language that you can use in real life right from the start, not just computer-generated phrases that don't really mean anything. You can also avoid a visit from the pronunciation police because the advanced speech recognition system helps you to learn to speak your new language out loud and gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's a bit like having a language coach in your pocket, and each time you use Babbel, you can pick up exactly where you left off. So Babbel's offering an additional 6 month subscription for free with the purchase of every 6 month subscription. You just need the promo code cycle24. Go to babbel.com/play. That's babbel.com/play and use the promo code cycle24. We'll put all of those details in the show notes. Babbel, your guaranteed path towards speaking a new language. Now it's back to the multilingual Daniel Freiber.
Well, Larry, we are inside. I don't know why I'm sticking with this this image of the castle war bus. It feels like you deserve your own sort of lair, at least, if not sort of fortified residence. Yes, Larry, it's almost time for the news roundup. But well, first of all, I said you've been at Tirreno. Have you been? Have you been the last few weeks? Haven't had you on the podcast for a while.
Yeah, it's been going pretty well. Yeah, the first couple of weeks of racing were nice. We went. Actually, the team's been going really well. So, yeah, every race we've done, we've had some nice results. So, won the Tour des Alpes Maritime with the team. That was really cool. And then, I had a couple of weeks at home, which was nice. But then the week before Tirreno, I got a bit of a stomach bug. So that laid me out pretty flat the week before Tirreno. Luckily, I recovered just in the nick of time, and I was able to go to the race. And yeah, it was a nice week for us. We got fifth overall with Ben O'Connor, so that was kind of like our big goal. And yeah, it went pretty well personally. I felt quite good. I was able to do a good job for Ben and for the team, and it was a nice race. We suffered a little bit in the rain a couple days, but it looked quite pleasant relative to Paris-Nice. So
I know it wasn't your official fan club. We know your official fan club, but there were some fans, some Larry Warbass ultras out one day. Someone sent me a video.
It was nice. I heard someone screaming my name on the side of the road on the big mountain stage, and
I think they shouted "Lucky Larry," didn't they? The Motown Maestro is maybe a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah, maybe that was too much, you know. Yeah. But also, some other listeners of the podcast were at the start of one of the first days as well. So it's cool.
Before we get on to the news roundup, Larry, there is some news actually regarding your team. I was expecting when I battled up through the undergrowth on the cold airs and made it up your drive, so to speak, or the staircase, and I was expecting to have to fight through boxes, huge boxes of new kit, because your team has revealed a new look. Two months into the season, we're ready to change kit.
It was actually supposed to be earlier, but Decathlon has they've changed their logo today, the company itself, and so with that we also changed our kit. So that's pretty cool.
That's already shocking. Decathlon changing its logo, its look, because I'm pretty sure Decathlon hasn't changed its sort of typeface logo for 40 years.
I wasn't around 40 years ago, so I'm not sure. But considering I only became aware of Decathlon when I moved to Europe, I'm not sure. But it does seem like since I've been here, it's been the same. So I think it's a big deal. We got a cool new kit to go along with it. You might not be as big a fan as I am, but I think it looks really good. And,
as discussed off mic, it's not that I'm not a fan of it. It does bear quite a striking resemblance to a couple of other kits. We were discussing earlier, weren't we, how this happens? It happens quite frequently. You get years when 10 kits seem to be the same color, and sometimes it doesn't seem as though the teams and manufacturers talk to each other.
Yeah, you know, enough. I think that's actually one thing that was really good with our kit the last 3 years is that it was really easy to pick out. And I guess that's actually something when they did market research is like we had the most visible kit in the Peloton or something like that, which, I mean, that was cool. I mean, I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But I think it looks cool. I'm excited to wear it. So my debut in it will be this weekend at San Remo.
I remember this being a source of a lot of teeth gnashing way back in the day when I was working for Mappe. 1 year they had a kit that direct sportives couldn't really spot in the bunch, and that really governed team kit design for the following year.
So they can't yell at the guys who were sitting in the back, huh?
Yeah, pretty much. Larry, let's begin the official news roundup before we start moving back and forward. Paris, Tirreno, and so on and so forth. So the first ever news roundup in Larry Warbus's kitchen. And we will start with some racing, and we will start with something a bit different, Larry. In Italy, for decades now, at the Giro d'Italia, they have a television program after the stage called Processo alla Tappa. And it's Processo basically means court case, and it's kind of supposed to be kind of an interrogation about what happened in the stage. So I thought I'd interrogate you about what happened in Tirreno. Larry, who won the stages in Tirreno? In order, please. Ooh. Can you remember?
Okay. So the first sprint stage, the first stage was the TT, so that was one I used. So very impressive time trial from the Svelte climber. Then the second day was a sprint. It was Tim Merlier.
No, it was Jasper Philipsen.
Oh, shoot. Was it Jasper Philipsen?
Yeah, it was.
It was Jasper Philipsen, wasn't
it? Tim Merlier wasn't there, was he?
Yeah, he was.
At Tirreno? Or
yeah,
was he?
Yeah.
Okay. You can tell that my attention
good,
was elsewhere.
Good, because that means he must not have won the other day. So then, I think, let's see, the next stage was a sprint, kind of reduced group sprint. There was a climb. And there was a big crash in the finale where Jasper Philipsen crashed.
The winner was the namesake of a large retailer of building materials in Germany.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of the German Leroy Merlin. Bauhaus.
Bauhaus. Yeah, Phil Bauhaus. Okay, yeah. Now I think I've got it. Okay, so then the day after that was a quite punchy uphill finish. Jonas Abrahamsen almost made it to the line. He got caught like 20 meters to go out of a really impressive ride out of the breakaway. But it was Jonathan Milan who took that one. So that was, that was an impressive finish. Good to watch. Then the day after was Jonas Vingegaard after a super hard day with a really strong breakaway. He did an insane ride where he soloed for many kilometers to win. Then the day after that was also Vingegaard, also a mountain stage. Again, strong breakaway, very strong. Dylan van Baarle controlled the stage pretty much alone the whole day, made the entire peloton suffer.
I saw an Ineos rider on my way here today, and I didn't really get a good look at him. Could it have been Van Baarle? Does he?
Van Baarle is on Jumbo now.
So, it couldn't have been Van Baarle.
Could have been Luke Rowe or someone.
No, it wasn't Luke Rowe.
And then,
the
Van last day was Jonathan Milan.
Van Baarle's only been at Jumbo for over a year, and they're no longer called Jumbo.
Yeah.
Dear me. Okay, very good, Larry. That was impressive.
I don't know if it was impressive, but...
Where did Larry Warbass finish? I'm a big Larry Warbass fan. I want to know where he finished on general classification.
Oh, shoot. I think he finished, 49th or something?
49th, exactly.
Damn, that's good. I only know this because you get something like 10 points if you're in the top 50. And the day before I go, damn, I'm 51st and my teammate is 50th. I was like, I have to find out how to leap my teammate to get 10 points instead of 5 points. And I mean, I don't know. We just did the stage and a bunch of guys didn't finish. Some guys didn't finish. And I ended up moving to 49th.
I was going to...
for my 10 UCI points.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about whether there were UCI points available. I didn't know that. Larry, typically, how do you find out... Do you, as a matter of course, look up where you finished in GC in the stage race?
It depends. I mean, you're probably kind of aware of it. But, it's like once we do our job, we kind of just sit up and ride to the finish, But... just by the course of doing your job and being there late in the race, you know, if you're somewhat of a climber, you aren't last in the GC, you know? So, but yeah, it's not like I was fighting to get a 49th. But yeah, but we'll take the 10 UCI points, right?
So that pretty much concludes the Processo alla Tirreno. Last three things, Larry. Do you know who won? You know who won the King of the Mountains jersey? You should know who won the King of the Mountains jersey.
I guess it's Vingegaard.
No, it was Ben O'Connor, your teammate. No, it wasn't. It was second. Sorry.
Oh, it was so second. Vingegaard?
I think. Hang on, I need to check this now because I've got Ben O'Connor written. I've got Ben written down, and I must have written that down wrong. I'm pretty sure it was Vingegaard. Let's assume it was Vingegaard. Yeah. Youth jersey. Ayuso points jersey. Jonathan Milan. Larry, I was at Paris-Nice all week, and well, I'm not going to test myself, but I did a bit of a thought experiment on in the Uber on the way here, and I got the stage winners right. I got them in the wrong order. I'll give you them in the right order. Olaf Coy won the first stage. Arvid De Kline won the second stage. UAE Team Emirates won the team time trial. Rain affected team time trial. Santiago Buitrago won on Mont Bruy. Olaf Coy won the following stage. Matthias Skelmoser of Little Trek won Friday's stage, which turned out to be pretty decisive as far as the GC was concerned. Alexander Vlasov won Saturday's stage, which finished on Madon Dutel, which you probably know pretty well, Larry. And the final stage was won, much to one of your neighbours' consternation. We were sort of intercepted on. Well, I was on the way to Larry's. Got talking with one of Larry's neighbours about the final stage, and he was quite disgruntled that there wasn't more of a sprint at the end of the final stage on Sunday. It was won by Remco Evenepoel. Larry. That gave us a GC of Matteo Jorgensen of Visma Lisa Bike first. Second, Remco Evenepoel, 30 seconds down. Brandon McNulty, 1 minute, 47 seconds down. Matthias Skelmoser, 2 minutes, 22. And Alexander Vlasov, 2 minutes, 57. As I give you that, I realised that I completely forgot to give the Tirreno GC. And that was Jonas Vingegaard, the winner. Juan Ayuso, second, 1 minute 24 seconds down. Jai Hindley, third, 1 minute 52 down. Fourth, a very impressive Isaac Del Toro, 2 minutes 20 seconds. And Ben O'Connor was fifth, 2 minutes and 24 seconds. Going back to Paris-Nice, Larry, back to the GC at Paris-Nice. One other notable result, Primoz Roglic finished 10th, 5 minutes and 33 seconds down. Now, that was quite significant, and we'll talk about why it was significant, what it might mean later on. But I just did look, before we started recording, at Primoz Roglic's results in stage races since the 2018 Tirreno. So 6 years ago, his results in stage races of all lengths go as follows. First, 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 fourth, third, first, 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 third, first, first, second, first. 15th, that was the Paris they crashed out of in 2021. First, 8th, that was a Tour of the Basque Country where he had a knee injury. Then first, third. The only thing I've omitted there are the couple of Tours de France which he quit early because of injuries, crashes. So, well, later in the podcast, we'll ponder the question of whether Boris should be concerned, whether he should be concerned, why maybe he should be concerned. But that gives some context as to how unusual it was to see him finish outside the top positions. Let's wrap up. Racing first of all, Larry, let's talk about two women's races that happened at the weekend. There was a Dutch doubleheader of one day races, first of them on Saturday, 1.1 race, the Drentse Acht van Westerveld, that was won by Sophie van Rooyen of the Volca Vessels team. Then the next day came the World Tour race, that was the Ronde van Drenthe. And that was one surprise by an ST Works Pro Time rider, namely Lorena Vibus. That was her fourth consecutive win in that particular race. Just two of the things I'd like to mention. One, reports in La Gazzetta dello Sport
and a couple of other outlets last week. Larry suggesting that Bora Hansgrohe get their Red Bull makeover before the Tour de France. Austrian energy drink company, having recently taken a controlling stake in the team, report speculated that Red Bull's familiar logo would feature prominently on a restyled jersey from the end of June, and that the new livery would be predominantly red. Now, Larry, the Bora Hansgrohe head honcho, team principal, I don't know if they call him team principal, but he's the boss, Ralf Denk, he was in Nice on Saturday morning, and with my ITV hat on, I was working for ITV at Paris-Nice, I asked him a few questions about this. Was it true that we were going to see a Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe team at the Tour de France? Here's what he said.
Ralf, we expect things to look different in July, not only as far as Primoz is concerned, but maybe as far as your team's concerned. There have been lots of reports this week about, well, renaming. Obviously, we know that Red Bull has taken a majority stake in the team. What can you tell us about, well, this rebrand, if that's what it's going to be before the Tour?
It's still ongoing decisions internal with Red Bull and Denkpor Cycling. What we will do, we will do something this year already, or from next year on. For sure, you will see the logos on from Red Bull in our team, but it's not decided yet when. So we speak internally when is the right moment and what is the style, and all this stuff like that is not decided yet. And I read the rumor as well, but I can't confirm in the moment. For me, it's much more important. Bora and Hansgrohe will stay with us, will be as well main partners. This is really good, and I'm super thankful to Bora and Hansgrohe to give me the opportunity to bring forward a joint venture with Red Bull.
Inconclusive, Larry. We don't know whether they're going to be red. Red Bull are going to be red. We don't know whether they're going to be silver and blue like a can of Red Bull. He was quite cagey there, Ralf Denk, about exactly what they'll look like at the Tour de France. Also, just about what the Red Bull investment means, there's quite a lot of speculation about that. The extent to which the team's going to move up in terms of budget ambitions. I mean, their ambitions couldn't really be any greater, could they? They want to win the Tour de France this year with Primoz Roglic. Any rumours at Tirreno?
No, I didn't hear any rumours about any of that. But yeah, I mean, I think it's really cool that Red Bull's coming into the sport. I think it was a sport they avoided for a long time, and I think it's great for the sport and cool for everyone that they're coming in. You know, I think they're a cool company that brings a lot of interest in a lot of different sports, you know, namely extreme sports. And I guess now we're finally extreme enough for them. I think that's cool. And I guess we'll see with Roglic. I'm sure they were definitely hoping for better in Paris-Nice. I'm still stuck on the fact that if you add up all of his results in all those races, that probably doesn't equal 49.
I was about to say,
that's how it goes. So
I think Primoz Roglic knows where he finishes on GC at the end of every race.
I think he usually does. He might have forgotten some of them, but yeah.
Larry, final item on the agenda, also equipment related. It regards, the already infamous Giro time trial helmets unveiled by Visma Lisa Bike, first on stage one of Tirreno, and then the following day also used at Paris-Nice in the team time trial. The following day, so after Paris-Nice, after the team time trial in Paris-Nice, UCI promptly announced they would carry out an in-depth analysis of rules around helmet design, citing a concern that manufacturers were prioritizing performance over safety. Surely not. The UCI statement also, it also contained details of the forthcoming ban on the head sock component of specialized TT5 helmets. We've seen this sort of super snood head sock balaclava. It's been used for a couple of years now, hasn't it, by specialized sponsored teams. That is being outlawed from April the 1st. Obviously, Larry, Visma Lisabike were pretty upset when they heard that UCI are carrying out a review, because they've been working on this helmet with Giro for a long time, and their sort of aerodynamics guru. I also spoke to Pranis on the morning of the team time trial, and well, he laid out to me exactly why it's a good helmet, why it works, and why it is very much within the rules. And Mathieu Heiber, he said, well, the rules were drawn up a year ago regarding dimensions and safety. We in the helmet manufacturer Giro started working within those frameworks. He said that the UCI's announcement was driven by emotions and reactions on social media. He said, I have no problem with jokers on the internet. But if the UCI has a problem with the design, they should have indicated this when the helmet was submitted to for approval. Difficult to disagree with that, isn't it,
Larry? Yeah, no, I mean, I feel the same. I mean, yeah, it's a crazy looking helmet, but I'm sure it's super fast. They didn't design it that way just to get a bunch of people talking on social media. And yeah, I agree. I mean, to me, it's regardless of what you think of how it looks, I mean, they designed this helmet within the UCI rules. They submitted it to the UCI for approval. The UCI approved it. So what's the issue? You know, to me, I just think that's really stupid if the UCI goes and backtracks now. I mean, you know, maybe they could have been tighter with the rules in the first place. Sure, fine. You know, like then you won't get a crazy looking Darth Vader helmet or whatever. But I mean, Jumbo just used the regulations available to them. And with Giro, they designed what they believe to be the fastest helmet, which I'm sure is extremely fast. I mean, to me, it's just dumb that the UCI is just going to go back now because all these people freaked out on social media.
I mean, this idea of the UCI being concerned that manufacturers are prioritizing performance over safety, shock horror. I mean, how utilitarian do they want the bikes and the equipment to be? Or will we see World Tour teams with kind of shopping baskets on the front of their bikes at some point soon?
I don't know. I mean, sure, they could maybe up the safety if they wanted. But I mean, knowing Giro, they're an excellent company. You know, I've had them in the past on some of my former teams, and I would say they're probably one of the gold standards in terms of helmets. So without a doubt, it would be a safe helmet. And I'm sure it's actually way safer than certain other helmet brands that other teams are using because it's an American brand and we have higher standards of helmet safety requirements in the US. So I'm sure the helmet is plenty safe. It's big enough, so surely they're able to put plenty of safety features inside. But yeah, you know, I'm sure it has nothing to do with safety, their review. It's just more that people are upset that it looks crazy. But anyway, that's how it goes.
Well, Larry, I've had a very pleasant weekend because I feel as though, I feel like Joe Biden, or dare I say Donald Trump, I feel like I'm on some kind of American presidential campaign because I've been visiting the people of your great home nation in the last couple of days because, well, yesterday I spent a lot of the day with Joe Dombrowski. Today I've made it up the mountain, up off the coast to Ayres, and here we are in this very palatial setting overlooking the Mediterranean in your beautiful home. And yesterday morning, Larry, I also had a date with the new winner, the newly crowned champion of Paris-Nice, the first American to win since Floyd Landis, I believe, was
Bobby Julich now.
Landis was a year after Julich, really? I think it went Julich, okay. Landis. And yes, Matteo Jorgensen, as already discussed, the new winner of Paris-Nice on Sunday. And Larry, I said that I had a rendezvous with Matteo, which we're going to hear that interview in just a moment. And the venue for that meeting was the Café du Cycliste, just under your old gaff, still Joe Dombrowski's gaff in the Vieux-Port in Nice. Fond memories?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I lived with Joe for 5 years. We only lived for 1 year.
He said it was six. You've airbrushed one year.
Anyway. It was really nice living together. And I have good memories. And I really enjoyed living in Nice too. That was cool. Cool place to live. And I'm happy where I live now. I enjoy living a little bit more like...
You've climbed the greasy pole of Côte d'Azur living though. You know, when one moves up, geographically, physically, does one also move up in terms of status?
I don't know. I mean, living next to the water is also cool, right?
Overlooking those yachts.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, no, both are good places. But yeah, both are cool. Fond memories either way.
Well, Larry, let's go back to yesterday morning, shall we? Let's go back to my meeting with Matteo Jorgensen in the Café du Cycliste. And, well, pretty simply, Larry, he told me how he had won Paris-Nice. Well, Matteo, you are very much, well, not native because you weren't born in these parts, but you're very familiar with where we are. We're in Nice, your hometown. Just tell us, well, in fact, where we are for the benefit of the listeners.
We are sitting in Café du Cycliste, which is a classic Nice staple. It's a cafe on the port, and we're surrounded by trendy cycling clothing.
And Matteo, did you get up to anything interesting over the weekend?
Yeah, had a good weekend.
You won Paris-Nice this weekend, and well, we were just talking off mic, and I said I sort of imagined what it was, or tried to imagine what it was like for you to win Paris-Nice. You have lived in this town for a while. It feels as though you really sort of settled here, and it's actually quite close to your heart. And I think, you know, just from the outside watching you yesterday, that sort of made it special, because you could sort of tell how much it meant to you, even standing on the podium listening to the national anthem and so on and so forth. But I was also saying that cycling is a big sport, it's an important sport, but it's not so big that when you left your front door today, there were hordes waiting to greet you. How's it been the last not quite 24 hours?
It's been cool. It's been it's something where when you don't expect something, it makes it a lot different feeling and a lot better. I think when something's unexpected, your brain just has a different response. And so like you said, I think being in such a familiar environment is also cool in some ways. It's just so different from every bike race you do. Like my teammates drove me to my apartment from the finish line in the team van, and then we went to dinner, and it's just a strange thing. Like I slept in my own bed and woke up this morning, and yeah, it's never like that with bike racing. Usually you're sitting in a security line in some airport and 6 a.m. and just not super happy. So it's been really nice, actually.
What were some of the maybe images, thoughts, feelings going through your head when you were standing on the podium listening to the national anthem yesterday?
Yeah, a lot of thoughts. I think it was a lot of quite a bit of relief, just because I started to feel it had been years since I felt nervous for a race or nervous like that. Like it felt like I was like 14 again and I was about to do the national championships or something. And yeah, then I think it was, Saturday night, I just like was sitting there going, because you know, it's one thing that I knew the stage, and I think it's a positive and a negative, because yeah, I knew there were a million places where Remco could have attacked me, you know, and I was just sitting there. It's not like we had the team to control the race anyway, so there was so much unpredictability with it that it made it a bit scary, or just a daunting thing that I was going into. But yeah, I think finishing it and having it go so well just was a pretty pretty cool experience.
And nerves, well, they're a good thing in that they tell us our nervous system's working, and you know, we get nervous when we're excited and when good things are about to happen. But people's instinct is still to fight nerves, and it's not pleasant. Mm-hmm. And it also kind of introduces the fear in your mind that the nerves might handicap you or might mess things up. Mm-hmm. How did you try to, when you felt those nerves before the stage and on Saturday night, did you manage that well in the sense that you didn't try and fight them?
Maybe. Yeah, like you said, I think it's not that the nerves itself are bad, but I yeah, we did a pretty hard bike race up to that point, and I really wanted a good night of sleep before Sunday, and that was the main thing. I just wanted to sleep well, and it was a bit hard to fall asleep. And I woke up also super early, just like alert immediately. So I don't know if I handled it well. I just tried my best, but I mean, I had really good legs on Sunday, so it obviously didn't affect me so much.
I always think that in sports like cycling, as opposed to a sport like, well, golf is one that's very much exposed to nerves when people are stationary, and it feels as though the nerves can almost attack them. In cycling, I guess once you're moving, once your heart's, you know, once your heart rate is above 140 or whatever,
yeah,
then that kind of negates some of the nerves, and you sort of, it puts you back in the moment.
Right. No, that is true. That is true. When you're exercising and you're going so hard anyway, you're just actually just focused on the effort itself and staying efficient, and there's just a million things to think about anyway. So once you're in the bike race, it's fine. It's more just that it's pretty important to get your parasympathetic nervous system to start up at night and to recover a bit, because it was a pretty hard bike race, so but it went fine, I think, this time.
So tell me the story of the week. Yesterday morning before the stage, I reminded you when I was asking you questions for ITV that you'd done a recon on the 29th of February of the whole of the last stage. So you were here just before Paris-Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Then you went up to Paris. Did you do some recons of the team time trial before?
No.
You went to Paris and then it kicked off. tell me the story of the week.
Yeah. I guess I better think back to, feels like a long time ago that we started. I remember we didn't do a recon, but we did. I got there I think I got there on the Friday night, and the race started on Sunday, so we had Saturday just a pre-ride, and we did on our TT bikes just outside of Paris somewhere. We found some road and tried to do some turns in the TTT position in the order that we were going to do it, and it was dumping rain. It was like so cold, and we ended up calling it after like 30 minutes and riding home because we were all super wet and tired. And I'd just come from Tenerife like the week before, which was like 30 degrees Celsius every day, and we were in short every single day that we were there for 3 weeks, so that was a shock. But I think it put me a bit in the mindset of what Paris-Nice is going to be like, because
is generally like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's an unpleasant, it's not the most pleasant start usually. And yeah, the first days went like that. It was like how you expect Paris-Nice to be, where it just stressed the whole day for not really any reason, but it's stress because everyone knows it's going to be stressful basically. And so it just like kind of spirals on itself. Like the roads are always dangerous with islands and traffic, furniture and all this stuff, and corners and towns, so every team is trying to be at the front, and you end up just the whole day just being there bar to bar with guys. And yeah, the first few days were normal like that, I guess. But I remember actually distinctly, I told one of my teammates after stage one, I was like, that's the least stressful stage one that I've ever had. And I don't think it was because the race was less stressful, but this team just does a really good job of staying at the front the whole time. And we really had like super clear direction on like the stage itself and how it was going to go. And it was also good that we had Olav as a sprint, because that keeps everyone a bit more in the game. Like when your goal is just to stay safe, it's you don't have the same drive to like really enter these corners first. So with Olav there, it was like, okay, we need to be at certain points, we need to be up there, and he needed to stay efficient through the day. So this helped me a lot actually.
And then I suppose the first important GC day was always going to be the team time trial. Mm-hmm. A lot of talk about helmets before the team time trial, but I think it was actually reading L'Equipe this morning, they sort of made the point, and I hadn't really thought of this, that obviously you guys were hampered by the weather and you lost time because of the weather, as did a lot of teams. Maybe that helped you later in the week, in the sense that when you did make your decisive attack on Friday,
mm-hmm.
maybe there was less panic in the group behind than there would have been ordinarily if you were closer to the lead. I don't know how you feel about that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah. I don't... I think on that, on the Kölsker Lude, I think I was more playing on the hesitation between Primoz and Remco more than anything. I think the other guys were just hanging on for dear life anyway, so I don't think it really helped to be farther back in the TTT. But I also, that being said, I would have liked to be farther up in the TTT. I wasn't super happy with how it went. Not because we did a bad performance, but just because of how the conditions played a part. And yeah, it just was kind of annoying to lose so much time in a day where I think we actually did a really good ride. But also Remco had the same conditions. It was mostly just UAE and I think EF or a few teams that had a clear run at it and proper wind. And so yeah, in the end, thankfully, it didn't have an effect on the final result.
And that attack on Friday, it turned out to be the perfect moment. I think most people would probably agree, and yesterday they would have agreed that you were the strongest guy in the race, probably, or at least as strong as anyone else in the race. But bike races turn on such sort of fine, such fine margins that, you know, had you made that attack 100 meters later, 100 meters earlier, it might not have worked. I mean, do you sort of are you just very, very grateful that you chose that exact moment? And how much kind of luck was involved in that? Or how much judgment, how much planning, how much instruction from the team car?
Yeah, it was a really... I am grateful that that day worked out like it did. There wasn't like a clear... It's not like in the bus before we said that we were going to attack this climb. And also, I think that was just the case for the whole week. I think the directors here just... We didn't enter the week with they just didn't have the confidence, I think, that I had the legs to win the race. So yeah, you have to make other plans. You can't just always race for the win, even if it's better to be realistic. So that day, it's not like we were planning, the day. We were just trying to enter the climb in good position and then just kind of, make the best of it. But I do remember specifically, having a conversation with Mark at some point, maybe that morning, about how, if I see hesitation, like, there's no reason to hesitate myself. I think it's only good to take advantage of that. And we also saw on the Mont Berulie stage just the precedent set that really no team is going to control that race at all. Like, it was this edition of Paris-Nice was really strange in the way that, like, there was no team that either had the strength to do it or had the plan to control the race ever. And so it just seeing Plap and Butrago do it, like, I was there on the front line when literally Plap just rode off the front. And it's not like he's a bad rider. He was like second at UAE or something last year. And I just remember it felt a bit surreal. Like, we were just watching him go, and it was just because there's two superstars in the race, and that's, Primoz and Remco. And I guess you always say, like, when there's two really strong guys, you always say, oh, you need to capitalize on that, and they're going to look at each other. But the amount of times that happens is almost never in a bike race, because the two strongest guys are the two strongest guys. And if there's a third guy that can take advantage, usually he's just as strong. So it doesn't work out like that. But this time, I think it did, and we saw countless times throughout the week that, just kind of, these moves against those two guys can work. And so, I just chose a good moment, I think. And I also felt really, really in control on that climb. I was just basically waiting for Remco to close the gap, and I knew that, you know, Primoz had attacked him, and so he was going to be annoyed with that, and, you know, it took him really a while to get back, which surprised me. Like, I thought he would just kind of sprint back to his wheel, but it took him a bit, and I couldn't tell if he was doing it to pace or just on the limit, but I just chose, I think, the right moment, really. Mm-hmm.
You said that there wasn't necessarily confidence that you did have the legs to win this race when the week started. Were you confident that... I know, you know, Marc Riff, your director sportif, said yesterday, I think he said, we were going to go for a top 10, and you had said, no, I think I can aim higher than that.
Yeah.
I mean, how confident were you, and what was that based on?
Yeah, that's true. We'd had like two new things for me, which were full length like tactical discussion calls about this race beforehand, once in January already, and then once just a few weeks before. And yeah, Mark and the managers of the team, they thought basically just shoot for a top 10 with Wilco and I. They didn't have any other objective than that, and I remember on the call, I was like, but I don't, that's not what I'm here for. Like, I'd already been eighth at this race twice. And last year, like, I just remember finishing eighth again and just being like, not at all happy with it. Like, I think I did a good ride that last day, but it didn't give me any satisfaction because I just was eighth again. And so I told him that day, I was like, yeah, okay, you can have that intention, but for me personally, I'm trying to go for the podium, and we qualified that and said, okay, top five would be good. And yeah, I told him the podium I think is possibility. So I definitely had good feelings from opening weekend. I think that's what set the precedent. I came straight from Tenerife to Belgium and just had insane legs there, and a level that I had never seen before. So I think that gave me confidence, and maybe Mark just hadn't he just maybe hadn't caught up, or he wasn't in my body, so he couldn't feel that.
Reading interviews you've done in the past, and also other people, was it Toby Stanton, one of your former coaches, that talked about confidence, and that's something that you've had to work on, though, isn't it? Something that has grown kind of slowly. You've not necessarily always been the most confident rider.
Totally. I wasn't like... I think a lot of it was development based. Like, as a kid, I think I hit puberty a bit later, and so I wasn't like a very good bike racer as a kid. I was like the guy just kind of fighting to be there, and I had to like really be efficient in bike races if I wanted to do well. Like, I had to do everything perfectly, and so yeah, it wasn't like I was just some natural talent. And it's a funny contrast just being here with Brandon, because he was the complete opposite end of the spectrum from me. He had like a 90 something VO2 and as a kid, and yeah, I was getting tested by Quickstep and was lapping the field at Kermesses, and so it was confidence is something I guess that has grown over time. I think with my physical ability, as I got better, I think I just got more confident. It was just a natural thing to happen.
And well, just to wrap up, Matteo, yesterday, you know, you mentioned Brandon there, and this felt slightly invasive, but I was sort of watching, observing you and Brandon behind the podium yesterday, and I could kind of sense you, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, I could kind of sense you trying to make eye contact just to make sure that he was kind of okay with it, with how it played out, and
yeah,
you'd obviously taken the jersey off him, and he obviously was trying to be magnanimous with you. He'd seen his friend win but beat him. How difficult was that?
Yeah, it wasn't difficult. It was I was kind of seeing how disappointed he was, and I just wanted to make sure to not like be next to him like celebrating full gas while he's gutted. But I got the sense that he didn't come to this race either trying to win it or with the intention of winning it. He was in a bad shape after UAE. I think they got sick, and then he told me on the first day, I remember, that he had trouble training the week between and just felt like not great about it and didn't really have too much personal expectation for the race. So it's, yeah, I just wanted to make sure that he was not like super gutted, which I don't think he was. In the end, I actually think he actually had a really good week. A podium here with, yeah, his sickness after UAE and stuff is actually a really good result. It's just the way that it happened made it just look, I mean, it just was unfortunate for him, I think, which is not the best, but yeah, that's life.
Okay. We won't look too far into the future of what you've got coming for over the next few weeks. You've obviously got the classics, but you did mention yesterday, well, you were asked a lot as well about what's changed this year, and you talked about how this team just does everything to, well, they really show a lot of attention to detail in every single department, and they're really kind of dialed in on absolutely everything. I was just wondering, is there an example of from the last few weeks, last few months, where that has even surprised something? You know, you mentioned yesterday the travel. Has the team, has there been an occasion where they've surprised even you and surpassed even your expectations just in the level of sort of detail? A moment where the penny has dropped of just how sort of professional the organization is.
Actually lots of examples. Just trying to think of the most clear one, but yeah, I think this Tenerife camp was a really eye-opening experience. I think the hotel that we stay at up there, they don't allow chefs to come and work in the hotel kitchen, and you're not allowed to bring you're in a national park up there, so you can't park like a kitchen truck and have a generator outside and all this stuff, so they just don't allow it. And so this team actually went up there and set up, like, they bought all the equipment for a kitchen.
So you're gonna say they built their own restaurant there? But
almost. Yeah, literally, there's one apartment in the hotel up there, and they just like took all the stuff out. The apartment's basically empty. It had like one little stovetop, and they took all of the stuff out. They went down, they bought all of like the kitchen equipment you need, oven, they invested in all of it, a storage unit to put it in afterwards, and then went up and like renovated an apartment just so that we could eat food for 3 weeks. And it was like, it took them a week of six people working all day to set up a kitchen for us so that we could. And that is just, I don't know. You have to sit there and appreciate it when you're eating the food, because it's just like, it's crazy. Otherwise,
not if the food's terrible. Hopefully the food is good as well.
The food is amazing. Yeah. When you're used to just eating white rice and chicken, it's like the difference is crazy. And actually, the first 3-4 days, the apartment wasn't ready yet, and so we were eating the hotel food that all the other pro guys up there are eating. And you're just sitting there after training, tired, and waiting for the white rice to come out, and it takes like 40 minutes because it's just like a world of difference. But then when you see how much it took to get that set up, you think, okay, this is like a whole nother level. So yeah,
that's pretty eloquent, I would say. Well, Matteo, I'm gonna release you back into Nice. We've already established, I asked you, you haven't been granted the freedom of the city yet. It feels like you should be. Yesterday, as I say, it was just to observe it, it was kind of heartwarming, because it also occurs to me, you're a kind of old school story in that it seems easier now for riders to come from all over the world and settle in Europe, and not to, they don't endure some of the friction that people used to endure of learning other languages and integrating. But you have kind of done it that way, and it really felt as though this was someone who had taken Nice to his heart, even if Nice has taken you to their heart to an extent, but that will increase. So that was, as I said, that was nice to see. So
had some nice words also with the mayor of Nice. Actually,
you did
at
have
the finish line.
Estrosi.
Yes, Estrosi.
He's quite a personality in French politics.
Yeah, and he, I see him biking actually sometimes. He's around just out biking. So yeah, that was a cool thing.
So you're making friends in high places. Well, yeah. Congratulations
Thanks,
again.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks so much.
So, Larry, you were otherwise engaged, of course, at Tirreno Adriatico, but I'm sure you had an eye on Paris-Nice. Paris-Nice is a race that you, well, you have a similar connection to Paris-Nice that Matteo does, as an adopted Niçois, one of this sort of American colony that you've all made Nice your own to a large extent. You also know Matteo pretty well, don't you?
Yeah, we, I've actually, the first time I met Matteo was when he came over here to race with the Asia2R development team. So that was in 2019. My first year on Asia2R, he was on the development team. It was called CCF or Chambéry Cyclisme Formation at the time.
The famous brown and green jersey.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And so, I mean, I have to say I had a lot of respect for him to make that huge journey then. And that year we did an altitude camp together in Isla Dumio. And yeah, I mean, already there he was really hard worker and yeah, definitely put in the hard yards to get where he is today. So I got a lot of respect for him. And yeah, the year after he ended up signing for Movistar and moving to Nice. So yeah, I've known him really well since then. We've spent a lot of time together, trained together a lot. And yeah, he's a good guy.
Larry, there were, well, a lot of interesting things happened at the weekend Paris-Nice from Friday's stage. When that move went with Matteo, he sort of forced his own destiny, or he kind of bent the destiny of the race in his favor on Friday with that attack on the Col sur Loup stage. Did you catch much of it? Have you seen?
Yeah, I mean, I actually watched the end of that stage over again.
Yeah, and well, a very smart move, and we talked about it in the interview there. There was a certain amount of, well, sort of serendipity involved. He chose just the right moment. There was an element of good fortune. There's always an element of good fortune. But as I said to him in that interview, he also looked like the strongest, yeah, or equally strong, strong as Remco Evenepoel.
Yeah, I mean, I think like, when he went, I don't think anyone else was capable of going. Mm-hmm. You know, it looked like it had been really hard. There were a lot of attacks and yeah, the pace was super high. And then he went and yeah, from at least the way I saw it, it looked like no one could follow. So obviously he was extremely strong. But I do think, you know, he rode a smart race. You know, I think, I don't know how it was in general, but my girlfriend said that he, you know, got kind of a lot of shit on French TV for not always riding with Remco, you know, a lot of times. But from, yeah, I guess from my point of view, it looked like Remco over the course of the week, I'm not referring to that day necessarily, you know, he was maybe a bit too aggressive, you know, like, I mean, he looked like he, while he was extremely strong, he wasted a lot of energy. And so a lot of people just were watching him, you know, whereas Matteo kind of just rode very smart and didn't get involved in, you know, the drama of attacking back and forth and whatever. And he just waited for the right moment, rode a really smart race and was extremely strong. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he just seemed like, yeah, he did it the right way. He was super smart and, yeah, he was well-rounded in his strategy.
I didn't put it to Matteo in the interview, but I think he must have said this in the press conference on Sunday night, and I wasn't in that press conference, but there was a quote in L'Equipe yesterday morning, Matteo saying, "I don't think I'll ever win a Grand Tour," which struck me as, well, very sort of self-effacing, premature, maybe.
I mean, I think he's just trying to be humble.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. He probably thinks he can win a Grand Tour.
What do you think?
I think he's capable. Mm-hmm. I think at Jumbo, it's possible, you know. And, you know, I think they wouldn't have brought him there and made him the leader of Paris-Nice the first year if they didn't think he was capable of big things. And obviously, I mean, he's capable of big things because he just won Paris-Nice. But, you know, I think he's a super well-rounded rider. He's super strong. And, you know, he's not like a small guy. So that means he doesn't just have...
I'm surprised how light he was. When I looked up his weight...
Pro Cycling Stats is wrong.
Okay, 65 kilos?
No, he's definitely not 65 kilos.
I was going to say...
I think he's around 70 kilos.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, if you're a GC rider who can do the great, you know, as good of watts per kilo as he does to go up the climbs as fast as the other climbers, that means you have a very large amount of absolute watts for the flat and for the time trials. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think when we see him attack some of the individual time trials this year, I think he's going to be on a very, very high level. So, you know, I think he was already really good the last years. You know, I don't know, he was like maybe second in Romandie in the TT last year. Anyway, he was top five. And his equipment, his only in position and testing, you know, he went to the wind tunnel with the team. Everything has just taken a step up this year. So, I mean, I think he's about as well-rounded as you can get. So for me, I don't see why he couldn't win a Grand Tour.
In some ways, Larry, one could already say that he has filled the Roglic void, certainly in the first week of March anyway. Primoz Roglic, as discussed, 10th on GC in Paris. It was his first race, of course, in Bora Hansgrohe, still green colours, and they may become red, as discussed earlier, later on in the season. Larry, I sort of hinted, just by reading out his results in past stage races, that I'm not going to say there'd be cause for concern. It's ridiculous to say there's cause for concern in his first outing of the season. It's become the norm that the Vingegaards, the Pogacars, they come straight out of the gate and win, but it shouldn't really be the norm. We shouldn't be surprised when riders, you know, need a couple of races to sort of find their legs. However, there will be some eyebrows raised on that last stage, the classic Nice stage. He was visibly cold. He was shivering on, I can't remember which descent it was.
It was off at the top of Pay. Okay. Yeah.
And it was at that point where he sort of started to go backwards.
Yeah, I
believe that was the kind of story of his day. He got very cold and it was nothing more than that, and he felt okay even on Sunday stage prior to that, but it wasn't quite the Primoz Roglic that we know and have become accustomed to over the last few years. Any thoughts, Larry?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, because I do think, like, I mean, having raced in the cold a bit this year already and having done the Giro last year, I know, like, the cold can make a huge difference. But I would say even before the cold stages, he didn't exactly look like his old self. I mean, I have no clue why, but, you know, I mean, I know Bora probably isn't the same level as Jumbo in terms of, you know, their training camps and... Yeah, I mean, like he said, their nutrition, I think, what did he say? There was too much salad at the buffet or something like that. You know, I don't know. I doubt it's the salad, but I think Jumbo is extremely dialed and he was there for a really long time. And I think if you're a rider who's only known the best team in the world, it's pretty hard to change. Now, I have to say, I mean, he has an insanely strong team behind him. You know, the team, like his teammates, the level of his teammates won't be a problem. But it's just whether Bora can dial everything in for him as well as Jumbo did.
Whether he can Vismify Bora. And there was a lot of talk about that this week. There's been a lot of talk about that since his first training camp with the team in December. I went to that training camp and we had an interview with Rolf Aldag, and there was a lot of talk about how much they're trying to absorb from Roglic, how much they're trying to take on board. There was more talk about it at Paris-Nice, but yeah, we shall see, I suppose, Larry. Well, there some of your reflections on Paris-Nice. Any sort of footnotes that you'd like to bring up about Paris-Nice? Larry, your team had an okay week. You probably had a better week in Tirreno than you
did.
Yeah,
I think
Paris-Nice.
We did. I mean, I think they were hoping for better with Felix. You know, I think again the cold really, really got to him, and I think he got like insanely cold on Madone du Tell, and he did the whole climb in his GABA, which, you know, that upset some people on my team, just because, you know, also those things weigh like kilos once they're wet.
I believe this may also have been Roglic's problem, that he got too hot and then got too cold.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the problem. I don't know. I mean, cold is just, it's hard to deal with. Rain and cold. I mean, normal, if it's dry and cold, it's fine. But rainy, cold stages like we've had in a lot of races so far this year, it's really, really hard to deal with. And getting it right it's a very tricky balance. And when you're as lean as, Roglic, that's hard. I mean, Felix is also super lean. So I guess when you're as lean as a lot of the top GC riders are, you have to be really, really dialed with how you dress. And I think it's a difficult balance, because you can't be too hot, you can't be too cold. That's not an easy balance to find. But in general, I think, then the last day, unfortunately, on our team, Aurelien crashed and then punctured at like a critical moment. So that really took him out of the race. I think they were probably hoping for better. And, you know, maybe if we had normal weather, the result for my team would have been a little bit different. But that's also part of racing, and especially in Paris-Nice, Tirreno, the spring races, you know, the weather plays a huge impact, and you need to be ready to deal with that. So, yeah, I still think they did decent, you know. I mean, whatever, they were 7th and maybe 13th or maybe 8th, or I don't remember. Anyway, it was decent. They had someone in the top 10 and another guy close, and they had some decent stage wins. You know, it looked like Sam was sort of getting his legs back under him in the sprints. I think he was 4th on one of the stages. So things are going in the right direction, and yeah, our team's been going really well. And now that we have this great New Jersey, surely we're going to get a bunch more results.
I was about to say, always be dialed with what you're wearing. Words to live your life by.
True.
Larry Warbus, pearl of wisdom. Larry, there's some of your reflections on Paris-Nice. Now we're going to hear some of mine, and more importantly, some of François Thomazot's. François, of course, is completing a bit of a farewell tour, never mind my sort of presidential tour, a farewell tour of Europe's great races. This, in theory, although we hope it's not, in theory, was going to be his last Paris-Nice. And at the end of that Paris-Nice, in the press room on Sunday afternoon, while Matteo Jorgensen was giving his winner's press conference, I caught up with François for a bit of a summary of everything we'd seen. If you hear a baby's voice in the background, that is the voice of, well, another good friend of the podcast, Seb Piquet's offspring. Seb Piquet's very young, less than 1 year old, I think, son, who's getting very boisterous in the sort of foyer of the hotel on Sunday night. Anyway, here I am with François Thomazot, just cleaning or rounding up Paris-Nice.
So François, I tried in vain to get you on last week's podcast, but I wasn't able to track you down. But you have been on Paris-Nice, like me, all week, working in a slightly different guise to the role you usually have for us anyway. You've been working for the organisation of Paris-Nice, doing the live website updates. You're a futurist. You're a man of the 21st century. François, let's share some reflections on Paris-Nice, shall we? First of all, was it an edition you enjoyed? An edition that sort of corresponds to the kind of canon of Paris-Nice, what Paris-Nice is typically should be?
Yeah, in the end, because it's just finished, I think it was a very classic Paris-Nice. Because if you look at the palmarès of Paris-Nice across the years, very often it's the same type of riders as Matteo Jorgensen win. Like I don't want to hamper Matteo Jorgensen's future in any way, but I mean we've had Marc Soler, we've had guys like Luis Leon Sanchez, winning Paris-Nice, or Sergio Henao. I mean, no disrespect at all. I mean, they're great riders, and Matteo Jorgensen is a great rider, but it's not that often, last year with Pogacar. And, I mean, you have years when Contador or Pogacar win Paris-Nice, but it's so early in the season. It's for some guy, it's only, you know, the big GC contenders for the Grand Tours. Sometimes it's too early in the season for them, and you don't see the best of them. So we saw a promising, I think, Remco Evenepoel. He came on Paris-Nice to learn, as he said since the beginning, to learn what the French roads were like. You know,
yeah, he's just spoken in great detail about that again. François, I don't know how exposed you've been to Remco and his interviews this week, but he never ceases to sort of amaze and delight me how amenable he is, how accessible he is, and the very detailed answers he gives.
Yeah, I think he definitely is. Maybe there was also a temptation for him. I mean, there's a market for Remco Evenepoel in France, obviously. He speaks French. Like a lot of Belgians. The French culture is there, you know, and so he has everything it takes to be extremely popular, especially on the roads of the Tour de France. So I think there was also kind of a PR operation for him to be on Paris-Nice, and but I think that's probably the way he is. I haven't come across Remco that much in the Classic or in the Vuelta or in the other Grand Tours he did, and he always seemed to me from the outside a little bit bratty, which is not an insult in my mouth. You know, I think it's when you're a young, promising, talented champion, you're entitled to moments of brattiness. And
we saw a little bit of it this week.
Yeah, I think we did. One or two moments we saw that when he, for instance, in the descent of the team time trial, when he accused Tim de Klerk of hampering the quick step ride, which was and then he apologized. That's the charm of him. So yeah, I think look at the end of it. He finished second overall, wins the last stage. That's the one you want to win. You know, most of the time, takes the points jersey, the polka dot, and the most aggressive rider. Any way you look at it, it's a success. The little strange thing about this Paris-Nice, which might be a little bit different from others, is there's never been any one decisive attack from anyone, including Evenepoel. There's always a moment in the past when Roglic or even Max Schachmann, when he won Paris-Nice, or others, Egan Bernal when he won it in 2019. There were kind of blistering attacks in the Queen stage in the mountains. We didn't have a real mountain stage, so maybe this changed the outcome. But Evenepoel was the only one to attack, and his attacks were not what you'd call, blistering or decisive. So that was a little bit strange. It helped probably Jorgensen, who doesn't look to me to be kind of an explosive rider, to stay in contention. And then there were the disappointment. I really don't know what to think of Primoz Roglic at this stage.
We'll get onto that in a second. Just what you were saying about no decisive attacks. I mean, I don't feel that it should be in the DNA of Paris-Nice to be won by a Tour de France scale attack. These big mountain stages, they've been introduced in the last sort of 10 years as cycling has become more spectacular. The efforts have become greater and greater to make it more spectacular with bigger and bigger climbs and so on and so forth. But that's not really the heritage of Paris-Nice, is it? The heritage of Paris-Nice is a race which a stage racer can win, but also someone who's kind of preparing for the classics.
Well, that's right. Yeah, there's both. As you say, my impression is in the last 10 years that they've tried to design a format of Paris-Nice that they see as a mini, 1 week summary of the Tour de France, and that's why we have the mountain stages we didn't have in the past. Still, you had blistering attacks, you had Contador attacks in the past. I remember Montagne de Lure, there were times when we went to the Ventoux. But you're right. That's why I said at the very beginning of this that it, in a way it's kind of a traditional and classic one, because you have a great winner, but we don't know what. I remember seeing Luis Leon Sanchez win here and thinking, maybe this guy's got GC potential for a Grand Tour. He didn't. Same with Marc Soler, same with many others. Max Schermerhorn won twice, and we thought that he would be much better than he was in Grand Tours. So
Sergio Henao
as well. Yeah, I mean, there were quite a few along the years that we thought might, make it from 1 week to 3 weeks, and it's something that rarely happens. I'm sure Jorgensen can make it to 3 weeks, but more in a top five, top ten finisher. And in my impression, I hope I'm wrong, but he needs a little extra to be in contention with the likes of Vingegaard or Pogacar, who on other sides of the cycling calendar are still impressing a lot. So and also Jorgensen is in the same team as Vingegaard, and other talents in the Visma team. So as you say, in that respect, I mean, we saw sprinters. There's always sprint stages. Olaf Koy, really impressive, another Visma little bike rider. The team time trial is a bit of a new addition to the format since last year. It was maybe a bit of an anticlimax this year because of the weather.
I thought it was interesting that, usually a team time trial, it's dangerous, it's risky for the organisation to include it in a short stage race, because it can sort of calcify the general classification, and it can put one team sort of enthrone them at the top of the general classification. They become hard to move then. But I personally like this new format of every rider gets their own time, particularly with the way these stages have been planned the last 2 years, with the little climb at the end. It's been interesting just to see teams take very different approaches to that. You mentioned Roglic. Now, Francois, as Matteo Jorgensen walks past, Roglic now ordinarily are a rider, he finished 10th I think, someone whose objectives are way down the road, that wouldn't be cause for alarm. However, the only reason it is cause for slight alarm is that Primoz Roglic's career since 2018, really, since he started winning the biggest race, has been a him as a paean to consistency. Mm. And if you go back and look at his stage race results, I think, well, there's one that hasn't been a sort of DNF or a Tour de France DNF over the last few years, which he hasn't finished in the top three, and I think it was the Tour of the Basque Country, where he was also injured and he had a knee injury. Every other race, he's finished first, second, or third in the last few years. This week, it was quite different. And I think there will be some concern at Bora.
Yeah, definitely. That I have exactly the same concerns, because as you say, I mean, Roglic won Paris in the past, or was in contention to win it and crashed. I mean, but it was always a race which he tackled with craving to win it, like it was an important moment in his season. He's a guy who is not racing that much, so every time he does, he needs to be there, in top shape and at the top. And I mean, there were no glimpses of him, because he tried to attack a couple of times, but it went like 10, 15 meters maybe, and he sat back. And I didn't find the Bora-Hans Grohe team, and it was. Yeah, I mean, he had solid, riders and teammates around him, and well, apart from Vlasov, who finally played his own car. I don't know. I'm a little bit worried, to be honest, about is he on the way down, or has he changed his preparation? Adapted to the Bora style, and is he kind of gearing up for the end of the season and to peak later because he's older now? I don't know. In any case, he was not the Primoz Roglic we used to, and I found the situation a little bit worrying when you see at the same time that Pogacar and Vingegaard are, smashing your position in other races. So, we'll see.
François, before we wrap up, in case the listeners are wondering who that voice is, who's that voice is in the background, it's Seb Piquet Jr. It's the offspring of Seb Piquet. Not Matteo Jorgensen, who did just walk past. Final point, François. In this week's podcast, I took issue with something Adam Blythe had said on the Strade Bianche coverage, and this links to what you just said about Roglic. That Adam was saying that we're so blessed this year, we're gonna have this Tour de France where the four sort of tenors, or whatever you call them, four Galacticos are gonna converge on the start line. They're all gonna be in great form, and it's gonna be this battle royale. I sort of said, if you analyse it, every sort of January, February, whatever year it is, March. We always say the same things. There's always someone who the previous year didn't do it because they were injured or because they had a problem, but this year they're going to crack it. And I kind of feel that about the way that this year's Tour de France is kind of taking shape in people's minds. They've created this idea that Pogacar will somehow correct the mistakes of the last 2 years and that he will be better in Vingegaard again. I think all the evidence points to Vingegaard still being a really, really clear favourite for the Tour.
Yeah, because I think Vingegaard's one and only goal is to win the Tour. Mm. When I think Pogacar has got other goals. It's been a while since I have the impression, and we saw it when he came to Paris last year, and he used to go to Tirreno instead. He used to go to Tirreno instead in the past. And so my impression when he came last year, Pogacar, was that he wanted to have Paris to his record. And my impression is that he's not going for six Tour de France, or he's more going for every single monument or World Tour race in the calendar. I think that's the plan. And that's why he's going to the Giro. And as we know, even Tadej Pogacar, I think, if there's someone who can win the Giro, back-to-back Giro and Tour, it's probably Pogacar, but not with Vingegaard in the same, in the same Tour de France. So, as you say, for me, Vingegaard is the number one, and will be and remains the number one favorite for the Tour de France. Pogacar will be roughly in the same position as last year, because last year he was injured, and this time he will have all the fatigue from the Giro. So, which. Yeah, it's a kind of a vulnerability as well. Roglic, I think, is probably a little bit, yeah, probably on the way down. That's the feeling I have. And as for Remco, the course is perfect for Remco, because for once there are a number of you know, important individual time trials. But I mean, Pogacar and Vingegaard are not too bad at time trials either, and I can't see Remco winning the Tour in his first attempt. So yeah, as you say, it's of course it's great if nobody's injured, then we've got all these guys at the start. But I'm the same. If I really had to put all my money on somebody already, my money would be on Vingegaard. He's not my favorite rider, but it's for me is the, you know, given that it's his obsession and that's his goal, and the others have other priorities. I'll vote for Vingegaard anytime.
This is not your last Paris-Nice, is it?
It is
oh,
definitely.
Come on!
No, it is definitely. It's definitely because I've done, I think, yeah, not far from 25 of those in the past. My first one with Phil Liggett in the same car as Phil Liggett, which was great fun in 1989. And since then, the last 20 I did were doing the live feed for the website of ASO. And that's not my favorite journalistic exercise. And I think I'm too old to, you know, to be kind of a geek and working for something that probably, you know, AI will do much better than us in 2 years' time. So yeah, you know, even if I didn't want to retire from doing the live feed on the website of ASO, I'm sure technology would put me on the bench anyway.
So you've done your last tour, you've done your last Paris-Nice. I don't believe you, but you've done your last Paris-Nice. What haven't you done, your last one? This can't be your last race ever, Francois.
I'm doing the Dauphiné later in the year. Same thing, the live feed for ASO. And I think that's it. Afterwards, I had a couple of lunches with the, you know, old pensioners like me, or would-be pensioners like Philippe Sud, who was the head of communication for the Tour de France for years, decades. And we decided that in the future we would probably pick a stage where we'll go, you know, buy a couple of bottles of rosé, sit in for, you know, on the roadside,
heckle, become hecklers.
Yeah, exactly. Sit on the roadside with handkerchiefs around our head, and you know, and wave at you guys, dead drunk. If possible,
commandeer a tractor and drive onto the route and pretend to be drunk French farmers blocking the tour.
yeah, that's sort of the idea. No, but I think I'll come back on the tour as a tourist, you know, just to shake a few hands and watch cycling, because let's face it, I think that if I retire, you know, if I become a real pensioner, like I go to Caracas, wherever place, just to go to the beach and do nothing, most of my time, well, a big part of my time would be devoted to watching cycling on TV anyway. You know, you don't lose the interest. And it's great for siesta as well.
Well, Larry, back to the present day to conclude today's episode of, well, not quite, not wholly to the present day, because we are still going to go back in time to talk about Tirreno Adriatico, but we're back in your kitchen and the sun is starting to dip towards, not below the horizon, dip towards the horizon, and I can see the Mediterranean out of your kitchen window glistening beautifully. Why are you laughing?
I don't know.
Yeah, I would. I couldn't live here. I would just be gazing out the window, feeling very wistful all the time. Beautiful, beautiful spot. I don't know how you tear yourself away, Larry. I don't know how you know, when you get the call to go racing, when you get the call to go to Tirreno. I think I would, you know, be planting a flag in the ground and saying, I'm not moving from here.
Yeah, that's part of the game, I guess, you know. I get to live here because we do those things, so yeah, it's okay. I mean, I'm just happy to come back here every time, so that's a plus.
Mm. Well, Larry, we've already touched a bit on Tirreno. Let's talk a little bit more about Tirreno. Let's go back to your neighbour, shall we? Because, as already discussed on the way up here, your neighbour was sharing some of his observations on Tirreno, and particularly about Jonas Vingegaard and how strong Jonas Vingegaard was. He was very strong, wasn't he?
He was very strong, yeah. I mean, yeah, he's next level, you know. I think... I mean, it'll be interesting to see once he and Tade get to race together, because obviously Tade was also extremely strong in Strade Bianche. And Yeah, so I think those two guys really, they're still on another level than everyone else, and it'll be interesting to see when they finally get to clash. But yeah, Vingegaard was super strong, and his team was also extremely strong. So I can't say I saw him much once we got to the climbs, but yeah, he's in good shape, that's for sure.
Larry, thinking about you, thinking about your 49th place on general classification. No, not thinking about it. I'm thinking about your team in TNA. I said you guys had a good week. Ben O'Connor had a good week, fifth on general classification. We still don't know whether he won the King of the Mountains jersey or not.
We're quite sure that he didn't.
But we were talking before we started recording about how your team's fortunes and performances have improved this year. And we've already spoken in recent weeks, and this has become a topic of conversation in the sport, on other podcasts, in newspapers and so on, about the equipment factor. I think everyone knows your team has made a step forward as far as equipment's concerned. But you were also telling me about a slight shift in, not so much philosophy, but strategy in terms of the way your team is using resources and targeting certain results. Just elaborate on that a little bit, because it sounds to me as if that's been quite a big change, and it's a big reason why your team's doing well at the moment.
Yeah, I think so. You know, one thing that I've thought in the past, and you know, I've said this to my coach and the team and others, is that we actually have the general level of the team is quite high. We have a lot of riders who they're really strong personally, and you know, I guess the thing is, the way the team has raced in the past has been kind of like, well, let's, you know, throw a bunch of darts at the target and see what sticks. And now it's a little bit more targeted. So, you know, I guess in the past it was kind of like, well, you know, help the leader, try to go in the breakaway though.
Too democratic.
You know, maybe just keep pushing to the finish just in case. And, you know, maybe we'll get Team GC or something like that, you know? And they kind of just, they didn't want to sort of take the stance that said like, okay, we're going to go all in for one leader. Because in the case that the leader didn't go well, then we got nothing out of the race. But that's kind of the risk you need to take if you want to perform. Mm. So this year, the strategy has really been, you know, we go all in for one leader and or maybe two, you know, and everyone just goes full for that. And that's it, you know. So it's not kind of like, you know, half ass this or that, whatever. It's normal. It's what a lot of other teams do. But like, that hasn't always been how it's worked in the past in our team. And so, yeah, it's kind of cool because everyone can sort of feel good about themselves going all in, you know, until a certain point. And, you know, luckily to this point, all of our leaders have been delivering, and that's really cool. Now we're as of today, we're ranked third in the UCI world ranking, which is pretty huge for us. Obviously it's still early, but yeah.
Seems like almost rather than going back to the future, forward to the past, in the sense of, a bit more like the old, you know, professional cycling used to operate almost to kind of feudal rules, in the sense that teams had a captain and everyone worked for that captain. And rather than a more sort of democratic way of thinking, where everyone's a special snowflake and gets their chance.
true. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, just to elaborate a little bit on what we were talking about before, was I think also, you know, Van Rysel's made like a huge push with the equipment this year. And I think, you know, the arrival of a new sponsor in Decathlon, you know, in the future, we're going to have an increased budget. And, you know, I think it's kind of just like all of these things combined kind of got us in a good momentum in a good direction, and it's just like a positive spiral.
And the team has changed fundamentally in management structure, and also some listeners won't be aware that the ownership of the team going back a few months or last year has changed as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, so actually I think it was 2 years ago, AG2R bought the team from Vincent, who, you know, was the manager and owner of the team. And since AG2R, was the sponsor, they wanted a bit more control of the team. So they bought the team and they put in sort of a new management system in place. And so they hired a guy named Dominique Serres, who is, he's the new manager. He came from motorsport before. He ran the Mitsubishi rally team or something along those lines. And he also was a rally driver himself. So, you know, I think he's not so bad in the caravan when you need to go down those mountain passes. But he also, I believe, was perhaps the head of the French Motorsport Federation. And so, I think he's brought
A bit like Ben O'Connor was perhaps the king of the mountains.
We don't know. We're not 100% sure, but it's possible.
Larry's house doesn't have internet.
I think there's just been a lot of changes and it sort of brought a fresh breath air to the team. And everyone's kind of excited and it's been working out pretty well so far.
Another example, Larry, without getting into too much detail about this, but the strategizing, you were telling me one of your leaders, Benoît Cosnefroy, is not going to do any Grand Tours this year. And again, that's a sort of effort, moving away from trying to kind of fit him into a template of a template that a Van der Poel or someone else might fit, where they do lots of different types of racing. It's a kind of an acknowledgement that his strength, Cosnefroy's strength, is one day races, and there's going to be no sort of messing around with trying to make him something that he's not.
Exactly. So, you know, I think Benoît has been incredible in one day races in the past. You know, we've seen him win Britannia Classic and Montreal or Quebec, I don't remember which. I think Montreal. And, you know, among other races, but every time he's either gone to a Grand Tour or, you know, like a World Tour stage race, it doesn't work out so well. And he just suffers for 3 weeks. And the only thing he gets out of the tour is, you know, a good video clip. He was a good video clip of partying with his friends in the middle of the stage.
Well, it's worth it for that.
I think that was probably the most hits they got of all the Tour de France last year, but the team wasn't super pumped on that one. But, you know, even for him, he was miserable each time he had to do it, and he didn't want to go, but, he didn't have a choice because he was one of the French leaders of the team. And I think the team did realize they can probably get better return on their investment if they send him to races that he can really perform at. So, you know, for example, for Sanremo, instead of doing Tirreno or Paris-Nice, he did a training camp just a bit west of here. With his coach, so that he can really target, you know, the race rather than having an unknown level of fatigue leaving a one-week stage race where you don't know what the weather is, you don't know how it's going to be raced. And, hopefully it'll go well. We'll see. I'll tell you after Saturday.
Our breath is bated for Saturday. Larry, let's just finish today's episode talking about Saturday, talking about Sanremo. When we have finished recording, I'm going to head down the hill, down the mountain. I'm going to take a train to Sanremo. You won't be getting to Sanremo until Saturday.
Yeah.
This is a race that you generally do, isn't it?
Yeah, the last years I've done it a lot.
How do you feel about Milan-San Remo?
Oh, I actually like the race. I mean, it's cool. You know, I mean, I also like, you know, how, like, all the history of the race and everything. You know, it's one of the monuments. It's cool. It's
short also, commute.
Yeah, exactly. It's close to home. I really like that part about it. It's cool. Yeah, my girlfriend will go watch. You know, it's just nice because I don't know. I just feel like I have a connection. You know, I can ride to San Remo on the bike from here. And sometimes we do that. So it's nice. There's something about that, and also just being such a historical, famous race. I really appreciate that part about it too. I'm a fan of Sanremo.
Tell us one thing about Milan-Sanremo that we may not realize.
Well, I mean, you might know this, but if you don't really follow,
don't
that
say
closely,
it's the easiest to finish, hardest to win. Don't say that.
I wasn't going to say that, okay. But I'm going to say it is insanely easy for a portion of time.
Even though, actually, I have another question about Milan-San Remo.
Yeah.
You can illuminate
us. Let me just give you that. Okay, probably the most dangerous neutral of all of the races. Although this year it's not in the center of Milan, so maybe it'll be less neutral.
It's a long way out of Milan.
Less dangerous.
Yeah.
But in the fact that, because no one cares about the start, everyone is so relaxed at the start, and you have to cross like 87 railway lines that go through the middle of Milan, there's always crashes because the combination of people not really being that focused and a lot of parallel railroad tracks that you have to traverse.
Tram tracks, yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. Larry, one question I do have, and I think I alluded to this last week in the podcast or a couple of weeks ago. Milan-San Remo is a race whose evolution in the last 20 years may seem kind of paradoxical, counterintuitive, in the sense that it's become the equipment and better training should have made the race easier for everyone, including sprinters and so on. However, the groups that come to the finish are smaller than they were 20 years ago. It used to be very common to get 60, 70 riders contesting a bunch sprint, or well, at least 40 or 50 riders getting over the Poggio and contesting a bunch sprint. That doesn't happen anymore. How come, if the race in theory should have got easier because climbs haven't been, well, certainly the course you do now is the classic course that was done for decades.
So you think it's gotten easier because like our equipment's better?
It's got, no, it should have got easier. It should have, right. Well, it should have got easier for non-climbers. It should have got easier for them to stick with the climbs. The climbs, okay, proportionately, the Poggio and the Cipressa should be easier now than they were 20 years ago for everyone.
Because we go faster?
Yeah, because, yeah.
I mean, I don't really agree with the equipment like really having a factor in that one. But, I mean, I'll give you my take either way. Is just that, like, what I think has happened, the biggest change over the last years in pro cycling, is that, like, climbers have realized they can win a lot more races if they race differently, right? And so, you know, there are races, for example, even the other day in Tirreno, when Vingegaard won the first time, like, Vingegaard shouldn't have been able to win that stage, I mean, in a classic old school cycling, because, like, the climb was way too far from the finish line. But they realized, like, if we make this stage hard enough and everyone gets tired enough during the day, and, like, then he can launch, he can go so hard on the climb that no one can follow, and then, you know, he's going to win the race. So anyway, whereas I think in the past, people would just assume, well, if it's 30K from the climb to the finish, no one's going to be able to solo that, right?
So now they beat you all up before you get to the bottom of the climb.
Right, but I still, that doesn't happen in San Remo. But what the climbers realize is, like, well, if we just go hard enough on the climb, no sprinter will be able to follow. Well, I mean, unless you're Matthew Vanderpool, Wout van Aert, whatever. So now we go pretty damn hard up the Cipressa, and then that softens everyone's legs. And then, I mean, stratospheric Poggio. I've never seen more than like one switchback on the Poggio in the front group. But like, because usually my job is earlier, but I think it's just more like, it's such an important race and climbers realize that they can win it. And so the teams with the best climbers will try their best and they have been successful. Or climbers or classic, very strong classics guys. So
They have been successful because, you know, for years it was a source of great frustration that the best climbers would try, but they would never get any kind of separation or any significant separation, not enough to go to the finish. So we shall see, Larry, what happens at the weekend. Larry, the names that stand out, the names that are going to be at the center of everyone's attention as we go into the weekend, are Van der Poel, the defending champion, and Tadej Pogacar, who has not yet won Milan-San Remo, but obviously
didn't realize he was going to be there.
He is going to be there, and he's obviously desperate to win this race.
I'd love to see a Pogacar victory in San Remo.
Do you believe, Larry, that that can happen?
I believe it can happen.
Do you believe that the strategy...
I don't know if it'll happen this year, but it can happen.
So he, in the last 2 years, he's tried two different strategies. 2 years ago, it was multiple attacks. Last year, it was the one big nuclear explosion in the place. If I remember rightly, the place where historically successful attacks on Poggio have always gone. What he hasn't tried yet, and probably wisely, because it's never worked, going back to, when was the last time someone won on the Cipressa? 96, Gabriele Colombo with an attack on the Cipressa. No winner has come from an attack on the Cipressa since then. He hasn't tried that one yet, that option. And he hasn't tried the Turchino either.
Yeah, the Turchino. Wow,
yeah. Would the Cipressa, would that be worth a shot 1 year?
I mean, I know a couple years ago, UAE did like an insanely fast pace on the Cipressa. And that softened up everyone. But I don't think... I think it's too far. There's too much flat in between. So I don't think it can work. At least definitely Tade couldn't go alone. The only thing that could work would be that his team could go really, really full to soften everyone up. But I still don't know. You know, you're not going to drop the favorites and then... maybe you just lose all your team and then you don't have a good position going into the bottom of Poggio, which is like critical. So yeah, I think it's just going to be like the same thing we've seen the last years.
Well, Larry, as we all know, you often pass him in training. So we are expecting big things from you. We're expecting an attack on the Cipressa from you, Larry Wolbas, on Saturday. Larry, I'll see you at the... I'm sticking around for the weekend, so I'll see you after the finish. We'll compare notes. And, well, it's been a pleasure to be hosted by you, not to have you, you to have us. Larry, what's for dinner?
Well, it depends if we follow the nutritionist plan or what my girlfriend wants to have for dinner. So
I'm not staying because one reason why I'm not staying is that Arsenal have an important Champions League game tonight, and I'm not sure you will indulge me and allow me to watch it. So I'm going to head down towards Ayres Station and be on my way to San Remo. Larry, seriously, thank you very much. And we'll catch up on Saturday.
Sounds great.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burnett.